All right, it's time for part two of the New World Order, The Creature from Jekyll Island.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day.
Cartel is in it, and what it gets out of it. In order to see how that functions, we must examine now the mechanism by which the Federal Reserve System creates money. How does money come into being in our country? I call it the Mandrake mechanism, named after that comic book character of the 40s, Mandrake the Magician. Before I go into this, I need to warn you folks about one thing. Don't try and make sense out of this, because it doesn't make sense. It's not supposed to make sense. Just remember that this is your good old-fashioned scam, and you'll be able to understand it pretty well. Furthermore, I want to tell you that I'm going to make this sound very simple because I'm stripping out of it all of the banker language and all of the accounting terminology, and I'll speak it as best I can in plain old English. But I can assure you, even though it may sound like it's ridiculously simple, I can assure you that every part of this is 100% accurate from a technical point of view. So this is how it works. It starts with the government side of the partnership. It starts, in fact, in Congress. Congress needs money, a lot of money, far more than its income. Taxes only make up a small percentage of what Congress spends. Well, how can they spend more than they take in revenue? Here's how it works. Congress, let's say, needs $1 billion for today's expenditures. So they go down to the Treasury and they ask for the money. And the Treasury official says, "You guys have got to be kidding. We don't have any money here. You spent it all back in February or March. Everything we took in taxes is gone." "Not to worry," they say. Together, they walk further down the street to the Federal Reserve building. Now, the Fed has been waiting for them because that's one of the reasons it was created. They walk in, and the officer at the Federal Reserve opens up his desk drawer, pulls out a big checkbook, and he writes a check to the United States Treasury for $1 billion and signs it and gives it to the Treasury official. Now, we need to ask a question at this juncture. Who put that $1 billion into the checking account at the Federal Reserve so that they could lend it or give it to the government? Where did that money come from? And the amazing answer is, there is no money. In fact, technically, there isn't even a checking account. There's just a checkbook. And that $1 billion springs into being precisely at the instant that the officer signs the check. Now, if you and I were to do that, we would go to jail. But they can do it, because Congress wants them to do it. This is, in fact, the payoff. This is the reason the government is in this partnership, because the government has instant, easy access to any amount of money at any time without having to go to the taxpayer and ask for it in the form of direct taxes. If they had to go to the taxpayer and say, "Well, we want to spend this, this, and this, and we're going to raise your taxes another $3,000 per family this year," they'd be voted out of office. Not a popular thing to do. They like the Mandrake mechanism. But that's why the government is in it. But why is the banking cartel in it? To answer that question, we'll go back to that $1 billion check and follow some of the money. The Treasury official takes the $1 billion check and deposits it into the government's checking account, which is, of course, in a Federal Reserve Bank, so-called. And at that instant, the computers show that the government made a $1 billion deposit, therefore it has $1 billion in its account, therefore it can now write up to $1 billion in government checks, which it starts to do. We'll follow just a $100 check that it writes to the postal worker that delivers our mail. He takes it now and puts it into his checking account in his personal commercial bank down the street. Now the money is finally out of the Federal Reserve Bank, so-called, out of the government side of this partnership, and it's finally into the banking side, commercial bank. $100 has been deposited, so the banker goes over to the loan window and opens it up, and he says, "Attention, everybody, we have money to loan. Somebody just deposited $100. We have money to loan." And this makes everyone joyous, because that's one of the reasons they go to the bank, is to borrow money. It's nice to know there's money to loan. So they line up for the money. But they're a little concerned because it was only $100, but the banker says, "Don't worry, we can loan you up to $900 on that." How is that possible? How can the banks loan $900 when there's only $100 in deposit? Well, it works like this. The Federal Reserve System says that the banks must keep no less than 10% of their deposits in reserve. The bottom line is that the $100 that was deposited there is 10% of $1,000. Therefore, the bank can loan up to $900, which is the difference. Now, where did that money come from? The answer is the same. There was no money. That springs into being at precisely the point at which the loan is made. Now, let's analyze it. An important difference here between these two functions. The money that was created out of nothing and given to the government was spent by the government for its projects. On the other hand, the money that was created out of nothing for the banks, they didn't spend that for their projects. They loaned it to us for our projects. But they collect interest on that loan. So the bottom line is that they collect interest on nothing, which is not too shabby. This is why the banking cartel is in the partnership, because all of this becomes legal. Interest on nothing. What are the consequences of this? This money that is created out of nothing goes out into the economy, and these new dollars dilute the value of the old dollars that were already out there. It's like pouring water into the pot of soup. It dilutes the soup. When you pour all these new dollars into the economic pot, it dilutes the dollars that are there, and so prices start going up and up and up, and we have this phenomenon of inflation, which is the appearance of rising prices. I emphasize the word appearance because in reality, prices do not rise. What's really happening is that the value of the dollar is going down. If we had a money which was based on gold or silver or anything else that had intrinsic, tangible value that they couldn't just create out of nothing, you would find that prices would remain stable over a long period of time. And to illustrate that point, it's interesting to know that if we had lived in ancient Rome, we would have been able, with a 1 ounce gold coin, to buy a very fine toga, a handcrafted belt, and a pair of sandals. Well, today, what can we buy with a 1 ounce gold coin? We can go into any men's store and buy a very fine suit, a handcrafted belt, and a pair of shoes. The real price of those items hasn't changed in thousands of years when expressed in terms of real money. But when expressed in terms of those paper things we carry around, Federal Reserve notes, we call them dollars, they're not. They're Federal Reserve notes. They buy less and less and less because there are more and more and more of them being pushed into the economic pot of soup. We're still not done with the analysis. So we lost some purchasing power. Where did it go? Did anybody get it? People don't ask the question, did somebody get my lost purchasing power? It's as though, well, it just evaporated. It went up into heaven or someplace. It's just gone. No. For every loser, there is a winner. Somebody got your lost purchasing power. Who? Let's track it. Those people who got the lost purchasing power were the ones who were right at the point where the new money was injected into the pot. Because they got their hands on it first, and at that point it had full value. But by the time they spent it and gave it to the next person, and then they spent it and it started moving out toward the edge of the pot where most of us are, then it lost its value. But the ones up at the nozzle were the ones that had gained on our lost purchasing power. Who are they? Well, it's clear that the government is number one, isn't it? Because that first check, that billion-dollar check that we tracked, went to the government, number one. They got it first. What about the money created on the banking side of the partnership? Who got that first? Well, the borrowers, didn't they? The ones that lined up at that window. That was the nozzle. Now, this is something that we all recognize. In times of inflation, everybody says it's wise to borrow. Why? Because you borrow dollars, but you pay back in dimes. Inflation erodes that thing, and you have contracts, and you pay back with money that has less and less value. So the poor guy that gets your payment at the end of the line has lost his purchasing power, but you gained it because you were smart enough to borrow in times of inflation. That's the way it works. That's one of the reasons they entice people into debt, because it's the smart thing to do. What they don't tell you, however, is that what you are gaining from this process, you are turning around and having to pay to the bank in the form of interest payments on that loan. Interest on nothing. The bank is actually capturing your gain through interest payments. Now, sometimes you have paper profits. Oh, look at the value of this real estate. Look at the value of this stock. People are paying more and more for it. But don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, that economic conditions can change and these paper assets can contract as well as expand. And when the economy does contract, as usually it does, always does, then people are wiped out. They don't realize that the boom-bust cycles that we have had since the creation of this Federal Reserve mechanism is like a sawtooth. The economy expands slowly for long periods of time, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and people think, this is going to go on forever. And then, boom, it comes down, usually very quickly. A lot of people lose their assets. And then it starts again for another 20 or 30 or 40 years. Oh, it's a wonderful ride, and then, boom, it comes down. And every time it comes down, people lose their investments. Notice, however, when you go to the bank and they give you something which costs them nothing to create, what do they want from you in return? Signature on the dotted line for your car, your house, all your assets, right? So if you can't make your payments of this nothing money, they get your marbles. They always win. In times of whether it's expansion or contraction, it doesn't make any difference. It was planned that way, carefully worked out. These people are scientists, ladies and gentlemen. This is the bottom line, that those who gain your lost purchasing power are the two groups that comprise the partnership in the Federal Reserve System, the government and the banking cartel. Now, this process is a tax. I don't care what you call it, inflation, or what name you want to give to it, it is a tax. If there's anything you remember about this presentation this evening, I hope it is this. that inflation is a tax. This is why these two groups are in the partnership. On the government side, they are able to tax their citizens in any amount, unlimited amounts of money, without the people even knowing that they are in fact paying a tax. And on the banking side, they are able to collect perpetual interest on nothing. Well, let's go back to Jekyll Island. We have a lot to learn on that island back in those days, because all of what's happening today was germinated right there around that table for 9 days. They had a particular problem, which was what to call this creature. You see, this partnership between government and banks was not new with the Federal Reserve System. It actually was conceived in Europe in the 16th century. And it was experimented and then finally perfected with the formation of the Bank of England in 1694. From that date forward, all of the governments of Europe had used this kind of a mechanism. Of course, they didn't call it the Mandrake mechanism like I do. They have another name for it, and that is a central bank. So, when it came time to bring the central bank mechanism to America, these fellows on Jekyll Island knew that's what they were doing, but they couldn't call it a central bank because Congress was already on record as saying they didn't want that, because they thought that what we needed in this country was something that was unique for the American economy. And these men debated what to call it, and this was their strategy. They said, first, let's call it federal to make it sound like it's a government operation. Next, let's add the word reserve to make it seem like there are reserves somewhere. Next, let's add the word system. This was far more important than it seems today, because remember, the primary concern was this concentration of power in New York. So they had to convince the American people that they were creating a system of banks spread over the geography of the whole country. First they were going to have 10, then they said, no, that's not enough. We need 12 regional banks to diffuse this power, or the appearance of diffusing it. Well, we realize today that what we got was not federal at all. There are no reserves anywhere. There's not a system in the sense of diffusion of power, and the Federal Reserve banks aren't even banks. So on all four words, we have appearances of the fourth kind. It was brilliant deception, and now the next step was to sell it to the public. The first draft of the Federal Reserve Act was called the Aldrich Bill, because it was sponsored by Senator Aldrich, and Paul Warburg warned him against that. He said, Nelson, if you put your name on this bill, it's going to be voted down in Congress because you're so clearly identified with big business interests. And Warburg was right. Congress put thumbs down on it. The bill of the big bankers. Well, it was a minor setback. They took their bill, they scrambled the paragraphs around a little bit, took Aldrich's name off of it, and found a couple of Democrats to sponsor the bill. Now, this was different, because everybody knew that the Republicans represented big business. But they also knew that the Democrats, on the other hand, represented the common man, you know, the working man, the fellow on the assembly line, like Ted Kennedy. So they found a couple of millionaire Democrats to sponsor the bill. Carter Glass in the House and Senator Robert Owen, who was himself a very successful banker, sponsored the bill, and now it was the Glass-Owen bill. Next, Aldrich and Vanderlip began to give speeches and interviews to newspaper reporters condemning the bill that they had written. They said, this bill will ruin the banks. It'll be terrible for the nation. And of course, by the time that got into the newspapers and the average person read that, they were saying, Golly, the big bankers don't like this bill very much. It must be pretty good. You know, you have to give these fellows credit. They weren't stupid. They didn't get to be where they were by being country bumpkins. They understood mass psychology, they understood politics, and they played their cards exceedingly well. Meanwhile, these same individuals were, out of their own pockets, financing so-called grassroots study clubs that were springing up all over the country, holding public meetings, printing and distributing pamphlets extolling the virtues of the Federal Reserve Act. They gave huge amounts of money to some of our better-known universities in America. Established.
I don't care if you're Christian. In fact, I will fight for you to have your religious liberty and practice your Christianity. I believe in that. I don't believe in Christianity, which means that you do not get to dictate the way I live my life based on your religion. I don't care what the Bible says. You have every right in the world. All those women who identify with your religion have every right in the world to not get an abortion, to not take birth control, but they do not have the right to dictate my life and what I decide to do with my body. I don't care about your religion. I'm so tired of having nonstop conversations about what the Bible says. You live your life in the way that you interpret the Bible. Again, I don't care, but you don't get to take the Bible and tell me, well, the Bible says this in this chapter and this verse. I don't care.
Well, 4.5 million people like this TikTok video, but there is a fundamental confusion going on here. The pro-life case against abortion doesn't appeal to the Bible. It appeals to science and philosophy. Let me show you. I am pro-life because the science of embryology teaches that from the earliest stages of development, the unborn are distinct, living, whole human beings. You didn't come from an embryo, you once were an embryo. And there's no ethical difference between the embryo you once were and the adult you are today that would justify killing you back then. You see, there are only four differences between the embryo you once were and the adult you are today: size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. True, unborn humans are smaller than born humans. But since when does physical size give you value? Okay, as Horton Hears a Who says, a person is a person no matter how small. In other words, human value transcends physical appearance. Sure, unborn humans are less developed than you or I, but so what? There are plenty of born humans that are less developed than you or I. Are we more valuable? Of course not. What about environment? Where you are has no bearing on your intrinsic worth. So how does a journey of 8 inches down the birth canal change your essential value? Spoiler, it doesn't. Finally, unborn humans are completely dependent on another for their survival, but so are newborns and the severely handicapped and the comatose and so on. Are they still valuable? All four of these criteria attempt to disqualify humans as valuable members of the human community so they can be killed. But since it's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being, and abortion kills an innocent human being, abortion is therefore wrong. That's why I'm pro-life. No Bible verses, no religion, just science and careful thinking.
Hey, thank you for being part of the French Files podcast. That's part two. We'll be back next time with part three. And as always, join us as we search for the cosmic truth. God bless.